is David Lazarus, a business columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. Hi, David.
Good morning.
How you doing there?
I'm well.
Well, I hope we're not getting you up too early there.
I'll survive.
All right. Well, I know I often catch you. You're really feverishly working on deadlines, and I was drawn to a couple of your stories, actually. Jeffrey Gale, a local activist here, drew my attention to you. You've been particularly concerned recently with solutions to homeless problems that are economically viable, that kind of are outside the social policy realm, but that deal kind of with the nitty-gritty, the basic affordable housing issue of real shelter. Is that a good way to begin this?
Well, I suppose so. As you noted, I'm a business columnist, and I cover a lot of ground. I go everywhere from railing against corporate arrogance to doing a lot of consumer advocacy. And in this case, I got wind of some talks that were going on quietly behind the scenes between homeless advocates here in San Francisco and members of the business community, specifically the heads of the restaurant and hotel associations. And they were just kind of feeling each other out a little bit, trying to talk about how we can address what for decades has been an intractable problem in this town, the gridlock of trying to solve this problem. And everybody in San Francisco agrees we've got a huge problem. Any visitor to this city, and mind you, tourism is our number one industry, any visitor here realizes that something is out of control. You've got homeless people and panhandlers virtually on every corner downtown. And the business community has long carped and complained about this and wanted to do something about it, or at least wanted city officials to do something about it. And when I heard that there were some talks going on, that looked to me like an opportunity to perhaps break this gridlock and put a little economic muscle behind efforts to try and move forward to a solution, because, you know, God knows we read a lot in the press about the scope of the problem, but you hardly ever see anything about actual solutions. And I decided to dive in and look at what was on the table exactly, what some of the possible programs were out there, and what would be the role of the business community. And I'll tell you, all roads led in this case to supportive housing.
I know that in your November 19th article, Lazarus at Large, A Solution to City's Problems, you mentioned that only 3% of the more than $800 million given annually to the 60 largest Bay Area corporate and philanthropic foundations is earmarked for homeless programs nationwide, an even smaller percentage, 1%. You note a recent study of about 5,000 people in a New York supportive housing program revealed that the typical homeless mentally ill person, as they're describing him or her, uses an average of $43,500 a year in public services, but that drops to 13,000 with supportive housing. And you know, you mentioned the San Francisco's Direct Access to Housing program, which only provides supportive housing for 400 people, has shown that 2/3 of their participants remain off the streets for 2 years after entering the program, reducing $800 trips to the emergency room by 60%, with a total of 71,000 homeless people, as you describe them, in the Bay Area. And that's, of course, a very low estimate. Nationally, nationwide, 800,000. Coalition on Homelessness, National Coalition for the Homeless, estimates more than 3 million. 7,000 chronically homeless shelter residents, homeless and shelter residents in San Francisco. And at another point in one of your other articles, you acknowledge that local homeless advocates say this more like 13,000 or more. What do you propose?
Well, I think when you look at the scope of the problem, you have to pick your fights, obviously, since we're still at the outset of trying to actually solve it. And interestingly, you were citing the figures for philanthropic giving to homeless-related issues. And one thing that we didn't note yet is that the vast majority of the relatively small amount of funds that is given each year goes to quick fixes like homeless shelters. And I'm not taking anything away from homeless shelters. God knows they play a vital role, especially at this time of year. But they don't address the root causes of the problem, nor do they seek to try and stem the vicious cycle of homelessness and get people off the streets on a permanent basis. The answer seems to be that you have to get money into more effective and long-term cost-effective programs that will turn this cycle around and get these people into a situation where they can start helping themselves, which is obviously where we want everybody to be in this case. And supportive housing is, to my mind, the best place to start. Obviously, this is an enormously complex situation, and you're looking at a very diverse population. But for most people, when you look at homeless people, you're thinking of what the advocates call the chronically homeless, the ones out on the street who might have mental illness issues or substance abuse issues. They're the most visible side of this equation. And supportive housing is intended to get these people off the streets quickly and easily and into a situation where their various issues can be addressed in a humane fashion. And in effect, what that means is whoever is running the program, whether it's a city agency or a private foundation, might convert a single-room occupancy hotel, for instance, into a supportive housing situation. The person who enters the program comes in off the streets, not a lot of hassles, not a lot of barriers like other programs. You basically say, here you go. Here is a room. It's going to cost X amount, and you will be here. It is your room. No questions asked, and here's where you're going to live. Moreover, the program then will provide a registered nurse, social workers, and other ancillary services that are intended to keep that person off the street in the room, turning his or her life around, and hopefully trying at some point to get a job, get back into the flow of things, and hopefully become a more productive member of society.
We're talking to David Lazar, a San Francisco columnist, who's calling us, we're calling him long distance this morning from San Francisco. David, a couple of things here. Supportive housing. You talked actually in the same sentence you said of developing supportive housing, you talked about converting SROs. I mean, I think one of the concerns that a number of advocates, homeless advocates, myself included, has been in San Francisco and other main urban areas is the destruction of SROs for upscale tourista type, fancy luxury hotels that have destroyed what really has been affordable and even some might say supportive, though you haven't got, a bunch of bureaucrats running around telling people what medications to take and, how to go and fill out a job application, which frankly I'm quite skeptical about, but I can understand that that's sort of the a la mode approach that's being used. Where is this going to come from? What would it cost? And isn't there a contradiction here if you talk about destroying SROs in order to create these new, that has to be more expensive than SROs if you're talking about housing where you're paying people to, monitor people, check people in, and also how much is it, an institutional situation? I'm throwing a bunch of stuff at you. But
sure, you're raising really good points, Robert. Interestingly, we're seeing a turnaround now from what you were describing before. Back during the economic boom and the dot-com nonsense, housing was a huge issue in the Bay Area, and SROs and the owners of SROs suddenly started seeing that, hey, I'm not that far from Union Square, maybe I could go for a more upscale clientele. That has changed, and in reporting the columns that I wrote, I visited a few SROs, good and bad, and a number of supportive housing facilities, and the people who run these programs told me that, surprisingly, there's more housing stock available out there. One of the SROs I visited had to be completely rehabbed after the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake. It was able to be picked up by the city and turned around on a long-term lease, and the people who are running that are saying, we're even seeing hotels that once attracted a more upscale clientele during the good times are coming onto the market. The owners are having a hard time with the recent economy. In fact, San Francisco has been seeing something like a 60% occupancy rate in many of its hotels, good and bad, and that is putting an enormous crimp on hotel owners. It turns out that there is housing stock out there, existing stock, and also facilities waiting to be built. I haven't really heard from advocates that this is going to be a big problem. The only major barrier right now is financial. And again, this brings us back to where we started with the business community. Supportive housing takes an enormous amount of money up front. It takes millions of dollars to get a facility up and running. And you get the payoff down the road if you can reinvest the savings from public services that are no longer being devoted to this segment of the population. And as you noted before, a trip to the emergency room costs $800 in this town, and yet the direct access to housing program reduced visits to the ER by people in the program by 60%. It's enormous savings. That money needs to be reinvested in the program, and that's what happened in New York, which is where they got their savings. Also, you start getting economies of scale. Once you get a large program up and running that is well-coordinated, which is something San Francisco doesn't quite have yet. We need an organizing entity over it. And once you get those economies of scale, the costs come down even more, and you start getting savings not right away, not even a few years later, but a few years after that. And then it becomes very reasonable. And that's where the city needs to keep its eye on the ball, because it's not a short-term fix, it's a long-term fix, it's a long-term investment, and the money will come once you put it in the first place.
New York is the city that you're mentioning as a sort of a model. I'm always get a little nervous when people talk about New York because there's a notoriously, well, what many of us regard as an anti-homeless, clean them out of sight policy, which has very little to do with the needs of poor and homeless people. It has more to do with the look of New York City and a social control model that has been pretty notorious in New York City, at least among some of us, perhaps not from your perspective. And I know you occasionally kind of weigh in on social policies. I'm going to call you to task for your commentary on, I guess, you supported the hotels ads, Don't Give to Panhandlers, back in April, at least.
No, I came out against that.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I did. I'm
misreading your column.
Idea, but they're picking on the wrong segment of the population, and they could be spending their money a bit more wisely.
Because I'm looking at an article that said beggars find San Francisco profitable. You wrote on April 25th,
mm-hmm.
And you state, well, maybe you're simply saying that people shouldn't give away money to panhandlers.
That's true, and that's a separate issue. Obviously, homelessness and panhandling are not one and the same. But in that case, I came down on the side of this is clearly a big problem, and clearly we need to deal with it, but enabling people by giving out money on the street simply turns our streets into a very large ATM. And I guess I'm leaning towards a more tough love approach in that regard.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It sounds like you're saying that you didn't support the big ads that said, you know, give to a... Today I did Tai Chi, donated some change, and helped spread STDs as a sort of way of terrorizing the population into any... Or, you know, discouraging them from giving away money to people, say, I need money for food. Or I need even hell. Why lie? I need money for a beer. Mm-hmm. People who have that out there, these ads were suggesting that people aren't being compassionate, but that, as you put it, and I call it a kind of newspeak. You're enabling people to be, you know, to engage in drug addiction or, you know, act in an irresponsible or unproductive way. You know, I think corporate executives act in a terribly unproductive way and destroy a great. I mean, we see the national administration in Iraq acting in a horribly unproductive way. And I guess we need some billboards about that, in my view. But the idea of going after people who are pretty much at the bottom of the ladder really strikes me as the pits. And
oh,
I guess,
agree. Let's call it for what it is. It's offensive.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, and not to defend the campaign, what I think you're seeing there is a reflection of the frustration and desperation that the business community in San Francisco feels, that decade after decade goes by and we really don't see any serious forward momentum in addressing these issues. Now, in the case of the, you know, let's not give money to panhandlers campaign, obviously that money, I believe we're talking about $65,000, give or take, as I wrote in subsequent columns, if there's that kind of money to be spent on a bunch of bus ads, there's clearly some money in the business community to be spent on some of these programs. And I think that's a very important point to be made, is that, you know, if you can spend the money on this, you certainly have the money for that. You know, but as I said, panhandling and homelessness, they're not one and the same, although for many people there's a lot of overlap and there's a lot of gray area in the eyes of onlookers. San Francisco has a lot of very aggressive panhandlers. It is a situation that does need to be dealt with. But in the case of homelessness, I think that is something that we actually do have a viable plan to address. And while we're looking at ordinances to you know, crack down more on panhandlers here, and that's a separate thing, the city does need to focus its resources more effectively on addressing the chronically homeless.
Let's go back to New York City, because I haven't really got the stats for New York City, and I should have. You mentioned in your November 19th Chronicle article this year that we're talking about a study of 4,679 people in a supportive housing program, and it's an interesting and dramatic drop in the cost of public services, but what percentage of homeless people in New York City are actually in such programs? See, my fear is this is the kind of, frankly, we're talking free radio, shit that you hear from people like Newsom, whose real agenda is to spruce up the city by eliminating homeless people, visible poverty from the whole San Francisco scene, as Giuliani to some extent did from Manhattan, by essentially draconian police measures.
And you won't get any argument from me. You know, clearly when Giuliani decided to clean the streets out there, it was a crackdown that was both inhumane and deeply uncompassionate. There's no argument there. I think we're looking at two different things, though. In the case of the supportive housing program that I cite from New York, you're looking at a fairly elaborate program that wasn't just a city program. It was also done in conjunction with the state. Mm-hmm. And so it was done far beyond just Giuliani's or anyone else's purview. It was, in fact, a coordinated and well-coordinated effort to try and address this program. It was well-funded, first of all, which is one reason something as substantial as that was able to get off the ground. I agree with you that politicians, both in New York and elsewhere, at first blush might be concerned only with the cosmetic side of this. How can we clean the streets to create a pro-tourist, pro-development environment? And, you know, let's be honest, you can't fault a politician for that. That's obviously going to be one priority, but that can't be the only priority. And that's the point that I think is so important to make here, is that, all right, fine, do what you need to do to give us cleaner streets. Part of that solution has to be a humane program that is going to address the root causes of some of these symptoms that you are tackling there. Now, draconian measures to put people on buses and send them to other cities, that couldn't be the answer, obviously. That just shovels it off onto other municipalities, and so obviously that sort of shell game is silly. On the other hand, if a city can, along with whatever cosmetic attempt it's being made to spruce up, also provide the wherewithal to have a safety net, to use one piece of jargon, or just simply a compassionate program to get people off the streets and into programs where they're going to be helped, that is the solution, clearly, I think. And as we said before, you need to pick your fights. And at this stage of the game, at least in San Francisco, my approach would be going after the chronically homeless first. And by going after them, I mean not sending them out of the city or cracking down on them, but rather giving them the resources they need to try and turn their lives around.
Now, we're talking about
supportive housing.
David, are we talking about voluntary or involuntary programs? This is particularly important, for example, when you're, I don't know if you've followed recently the dispute about AB 1421, the new Needles on Wheels program that passed last year that essentially loosens standards for involuntary outpatient commitment programs, kind of bring California, unfortunately, into line with a number of other states who essentially give significant powers to psychiatric authorities. If you've once been labeled mentally ill or psychiatrically disabled, then you find yourself that you're in a position to have to, you know, shoot yourself up with the medications regardless of the, you know, it's what you think its usefulness is in these circumstances, or you may find yourself, you know, approached by teams of people with needles. I mean, it sounds kind of 1984-ish, if you want to go back to the George Orwell novel.
Yeah, and Robert, you raise a good distinction. I'm not even getting close to involuntary programs. It's not even a subject that I've delved into to have a good opinion on. I'm talking explicitly about voluntary programs. Mm-hmm. This whole thing needs to be, to my mind, centered on an approach where you're taking people and giving them opportunities to turn their lives around. You're not throwing them into a situation and forcing them to behave a certain way, which sounds to me like a recipe for disaster. Rather, you are providing the resources to get these people off the streets, which I would say the vast majority wants. We're not talking about people who necessarily would prefer to be living that lifestyle. You're talking about people who just don't have the wherewithal or the means to get off the street and stay off the street. And that's the important distinction here. Supportive housing not only gets you off, and getting people off the streets is easy enough. You can just throw them in jail. Supportive housing keeps you off the street by providing the services that are required to just get your life in order. And I've met a number of people in these programs, and, you know, you don't want to get too gooey and you know, heartstring tugging about such things, but it sure is reassuring to talk to people who had issues with heroin, had issues with crack, had issues with AIDS, you know, whatever, and they have turned their lives around. I've talked to a number of people who are still in these supportive housing environments, but they also have jobs now. They're also talking again to family members from whom they've been long estranged. They are getting their acts together, and that's what I'm looking at. And obviously that's not a panacea for everything. It's not going to be a cure-all for a problem as complex as this. My point is simply, it's a start.
You've mentioned that you've talked to Reverend John Hardin of the St. Anthony Foundation. You've mentioned direct access to housing. You've mentioned Jonathan Vernick of Baker Places. You've mentioned a number of other nonprofits that provide some housing, and you finally, I'm looking kind of over a panoply of your articles with a proposal. You're estimating a cost of about $7 million to San Francisco to provide adequate supportive housing to program participants of $1,000 a year for, what, 7,000 people?
Mm-hmm.
Where's that going to come from? What do you suggest progressives or, and, you know, even Newsom supporters who, insofar as they support this particular program, how can they, how can citizens act to make this more likely to happen?
Well, I see it as a mixed bag. In the columns, I wanted to try and spread the cost evenly, and I didn't duck this side of the thing as many journalists who tackle this issue do. I wanted to lay some things on the table and actually get a conversation going. And to my mind, it's, if we do want to get serious about putting some of these programs in place, then we're all going to share the burden of this, and we're all going to do it because we believe in it. For consumers, the answer that I'm proposing is essentially an indirect tax. What I'm saying is let's place a 1% surcharge on any restaurant meal over $50. Which is going to, of course, affect San Franciscans, but it's also going to touch many of the visitors to this town who benefit from having clean streets and nice amenities and whatnot. But at the same time, it would spare people in the lower income areas, students and people who aren't going out for $50 meals regularly. I think this is one good way to at least get the ball rolling and have a dedicated revenue stream, but it's not the entire answer, especially when you're looking at a requirement to put up hundreds, if not thousands, of beds for an expanded supportive housing program. And that's why in my most recent column on this, I talked about the role of the business community and the fact that the business community has been steering its money in the past not really much to homeless programs. And of the few homeless programs that were getting some of the money, it was going to, I don't want to say the wrong programs, but programs that aren't addressing the issue on a longer-term basis. I think overall, if you have some sort of dedicated revenue stream from the public and a dedicated source of funding from the business community and the philanthropic institutions, you can actually get this thing going because, let's face it, annually in the United States, corporations and philanthropic organizations give about $20 billion. Now, right now, only 1% of that is going to homeless programs. If you were to double that, look at the enormous increase in funding you would get.
How have unions, restaurant unions and restaurant associations and hotel associations reacted to your proposal, or have you gotten any feedback from them?
Oh, sure. I've talked to them all, and they're nervous about it. They're talking the talk, but they're not quite walking the walk yet. They're among the first to say, we need to clean up the streets, we need to do something about this problem, we need to blah, 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 blah. And, you know, okay, fine, I agree with you on that. But then when I talk to the restaurant association about my proposal for the small, I think, fairly modest surcharge, they got very nervous. They feel that their profit margins are small enough as it is. It's hard enough to get people to go out these days, and they don't like the idea of anything that would raise the cost of a meal by even a smallest increment, and I'm sympathetic to that. Obviously, if I was running a restaurant, I would be extremely apprehensive about anything that would do anything to discourage people from coming out for a meal. At the same time, you know, at some point, if these people want to cavil about the homeless situation, then they're going to have to put their money where their mouth is. And so this is at least one way that we can channel money from the public to this issue in a way that I think we can all agree seems to have a relatively equitable way of doing it. I mean, if you don't want to be paying these charges, you simply wouldn't be going out for restaurant meals over $50. And obviously, once the politicians got their hands on something like this, you'd probably see my $50 proposal going up to $100. So, you know, there's obviously ways this could be shaped to try and get this coming from the deepest pockets as opposed to the shallowest pockets.
Well, David, you're going to cut into my $50 meal. Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm suggesting
my filet mignon? I mean, come on.
Exactly.
My pheasant under glass?
1% of $50, you know, is what? 5 cents? 50 cents? You
50
know,
cents.
Whatever. I think that's it's chump change. Now, overall, obviously, because we have millions of visitors in San Francisco every year, overall, that will add up. And I think that's why this proposal works on the grand scale we're talking about. But for each one of us, for each meal, I mean, I don't know about you, but I seldom eat meals over $50. But when I do, well, I guess I'm feeling extravagant enough that I wouldn't mind seeing an extra small piece of that going to a good cause.
What do you estimate will be the income from this? Have you got any figures?
Yeah, I don't have it in front of me, but I had it in the column, and what this does is it produces millions of dollars a year. Not the tens of millions or hundreds of millions that you need to make these programs work, but it produces enough to at least allow the various participants in the program to point to a dedicated revenue stream and say, all right, we know that much is coming from this part. The big heavy lifting obviously has to come from the deepest pockets, and that's going to be the corporate foundations and the philanthropic organizations that are spending money, that want to spend money. They're just looking for programs that they think are going to give them some bang for the buck. And until now, after talking to some of the organizations last week, I can tell you that many of these felt that investing in homeless programs was like flushing money down a toilet. They didn't think that they were getting the returns that they wanted, and so that their money could be better spent elsewhere. And that may or may not be the case. I don't know. What I do know is supportive housing and similar programs does work, and many of these organizations simply were unaware of these programs. And I thought it was fascinating when I talked to local foundations that got behind a recent report that came out for why philanthropic organizations need to give more to this issue, and they just simply said, our trustees don't know about this program. They don't know about its efficacy. And the point that needs to be communicated to these deep-pocketed givers is, these programs work. They have proven results. We're not just feeling our way along in the dark with a flashlight here. We know what we're doing. And hopefully that represents a turning point.
David, any indications in foreign countries of similar programs used or in other states other than New York City that you have any data from?
I know that supportive housing programs have been launched in other cities. I believe Washington has a relatively effective program. New York is the one that we look to because that's where the most extensive studies of the program's efficacy have been done. And so at this point, in trying to transplant this program to other municipalities, it's important to point to actual numbers, actual success stories, actual savings, so that you can actually put together a plan for this. Overseas, hard to say. I know that there undoubtedly must be social programs in places like Amsterdam or what have you, which seem to have relatively enlightened approaches to social situations. But I don't think other places have as acute a homeless problem as the United States, and so I think they're looking to us.
What about the current San Francisco mayoral election? There is a runoff between Gavin Newsom and Matt Gonzalez, who seem to represent two fundamentally different approaches to a number of social issues, and certainly toward homeless people.
Well,
have you approached these two politicians? Have they given you any sense of how they feel about that? And perhaps even more important, on the Board of Supervisors, is there a potential majority for this kind of passing this kind of tax?
Well, I've spoken to both Newsom's camp and Gonzalez's camp about this, and Gonzalez to date has been more explicit about supportive housing. He's used the phrase in speeches, and he has said that he feels that supportive housing is a key component in tackling the homeless issue. He hasn't really gotten into the nuts and bolts of how he would make the program work, but nevertheless, he's at least paying lip service to this. He's a bright guy, and he seems attentive to this side of it. Newsom has to deal with a broader constituency. He is trying to be all things to all voters.
Do either of them support your tax specifically?
I'm sorry.
Do either of them support your specific tax proposal?
Neither one has come out to talk about the restaurant surcharge, nor have they tried to lean on the business community, although I'm hearing behind the scenes that a lot of people feel that it's really good that this is now out on the table. So hopefully once the dust from the election settles and the usual task forces and blue ribbon panels get formed, hopefully we can actually have a serious and sober discussion with genuine proposals on the table, as opposed to the usual hand-wringing that has characterized San Francisco's approach to this issue.
And scaremongering, I might
yes.
add. We're talking to David Lazarus, Lazarus at Large, who's written a number of columns on how to deal with the needs of homeless people, and I suppose the fears and dissatisfactions of those who don't like to see them on the streets of San Francisco. Of course, you know, who does like to see people on the streets who don't want to be there anyway? But, David, I guess that kind of, you were going to come on for 15 minutes. We've held you for 35. I want to thank you for your patience, give you an opportunity to sum up and look to the future or whatever you'd like to say in the last few minutes.
Well, in conclusion, I guess I would just want to reiterate that we can complain all we want, but solutions are out there, solutions that can work, that have proven to work, and there's actually game plans to make those solutions a reality. This problem can be solved, and it can be solved relatively quickly. And in the case of San Francisco, we're not talking about decades. We're talking about just a few short years before we can have a sufficiently expanded supportive housing program up and running and well-coordinated, addressing this issue and this segment of the homeless population in a humane and effective way. And I guess, to my mind, as a longtime resident of this city, just to know that there's a solution out there within reach is heartening, but it's also frustrating that it's seems to be beyond the reach of many decision makers, and I'm hoping that once the mayoral election concludes and people can focus again on the seriousness of these issues, that maybe we can finally see some progress.
David, is there a place people can reach you if they wish to send you some commentary or questions?
My email address is dlazarus, D-L-A-Z-A-R-U-S, at sfchronicle.com.
dlazarus at sfchronicle.com. That's easy enough. David Lazarus, thank you for being with us on this edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Come back again.
It was my pleasure.
All righty. Bye-bye. And also a tip of the hat to producer Becky Johnson for running all over town, getting the phone connections made for that particular interview. My thanks, Becky. I frankly wouldn't have been able to do it without her help. We have a call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Robert, good morning. It's Chris Fredrickson.
Hi, Chris.
Hi. I hate to go from the global to the local and the mundane.
Please.
I thought maybe you were a good starting place to help with a problem that seems to be fairly prevalent on the streets right now. Word is out, and word has it, and I've gotten some really bad stories from some old Camp Paradise brothers and sisters that there is some stealing of tents and sleeping bags and blankets going on along the river. People were out panhandling yesterday just to get blankets to cover themselves, people that don't normally have to panhandle, and of course they had to panhandle on the dark side of the street.
Chris, is this stealing by officials like police and Parks and Rec, or private people?
No, this is stealing by other
other homeless
campers.
People.
And I don't know how prevalent it is, but I think that one death from hypothermia is too many. And it's on the weekend, so I'm going to go prevail upon the Quakers, and I guess tomorrow go to the Resource Center and maybe Salvation Army, but I think it's important that we just get the information out that blankets and sleeping bags are very badly needed. And I don't know even a good place that people could bring them, because these are people, of course, that are pretty much, for lack of a better word, chronic campers. The background of this is that there's 80 people out at the armory, and there's, I think, the church groups hold, I think, also about 80.
40.
Well,
as far as I know,
I think Ken told me that it was opened back up completely.
It was, but the maximum throughout the summer has been 39, unless he's
increased. Well, they opened it back up to families, as I understand. I spoke with him last week. At any rate, that was a little interesting slip.
Where are people going to bring these provisions that you're suggesting? What you're asking?
Yeah, because if new people, the problem with the armory is if new people try to get into the line that aren't recognized by the monitors, who of course are people who suddenly have new power, it's a bad situation. They don't recognize them, they can easily be turned away. There's often power that's misused.
It also has to be said that the armory, although the picture ID they're requiring is no longer California ID necessarily, but I guess the Homeless Service Center, as Karen Brock has said, they can take photos of you there, at least that they'd plan to do that. But the spaces, even if you're right, even if there's 160 total spaces.
80, I've heard.
Well, 80 at the armory and 80 in the program. I don't know about that second figure, but let's assume you are right. That's what, 160 for 1,500 to 2,000
exactly.
homeless people.
Exactly. We know we have thousands.
85% are out there. So.
We know we have thousands of people out camping, and they're probably not inclined to come in, whether there's spaces or not. They're campers, and they, regardless of their stories, they don't deserve to freeze. And if they're out ripping each other off, we can say all we want about that, but everybody needs blankets. So,
you know what I might do about this, if you're looking for a place to have these gatherings, I could talk to my producer about maybe a collections to volunteer a collection spot, and people could call in to volunteer a place for people to leave this stuff. That's a possibility. Another thing is, we were talking about this a year or two ago, is to have essentially a large protest at City Hall where everybody brings a lot of blankets, because the City Council, again, even though we hear Mike Rotkin panhandling for money from the public, that's mm-hmm. what he was doing at the last council meeting, rather than asking for any kind of expansion, you've got, for example, hundreds of thousands of dollars being proposed for the golf course at the next council meeting, but not a penny for a homeless expansion whatsoever.
Carl wanted to talk to you.
Oh, okay. So what I want to say before you go, Chris, you are an activist who lived at Camp Paradise for a number of months.
Yes.
And you've also assisted people in legal trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And you yourself have been struggling with issues of homelessness as well.
Yes.
So I got...
I'm lucky enough to be inside with a heater right now, but...
Not for long.
It bothers me that...
I'm sorry. I mean, I don't know how long that would be for.
Oh, right. Well, I mean...
You have some medical surgery coming up as well, as I understand.
Yes, I do.
Yeah?
Yeah. And, you know, hopefully I won't land back outside. I don't intend to, but...
He won't.
But...
Oh, ho. Carl. Is that your fairy godfather there?
But, I mean, it just really hurts me to see, you know, my brothers and sisters, who I still consider my brothers and sisters, out there panhandling for sleeping bags. That's not right. And, I just...
No, I appreciate you bringing it up, Chris. It's good. It's very good. I mean, yeah. Carl wanted to say something?
Well, unfortunately, I was not on, so I didn't hear what Chris has to say. So I guess she covered it about the problem that she saw, because she explained it to me. I don't know. Did you go into anything about what can be done, what might be done about this?
I propose possibly, the first thing that comes to mind is a protest at City Hall Tuesday night at the 7 o'clock council session where there's a new mayor, Mayor Scott, no new services for the homeless Kennedy, or sleeping band Kennedy, as we call him.
But in the meantime, we need...
That's 2 days off.
Yeah, we need some reality right now.
Well, I mean, I guess people giving blankets tonight?
Right.
Well,
I mean, the weather's not breaking yet.
Well, perhaps, Carl, if you have been at a point where homeless people from Camp Paradise were able to kind of mobilize. Thomas Levitz is another activist who's done work on this. I mean, I this is something perhaps we should talk about off air, but if somebody wants to volunteer a pickup point and give an address, people can start donating blankets and sleeping bags right away. I frankly would personally vouch for the integrity of this particular pickup spot. What do you two think should be done?
Well, first of all, if anybody out in your radio audience can respond on an immediate basis, they should do that, and we can give them some number to call, if nothing else, mine.
Why don't you give us that number, Carl?
425-4787.
425-4787. And it is cold out there, folks. Just stick your hand outside. The sun's out and it's freezing out there. It feels pretty darn cold to me.
Yeah. Anyway. And
425-4787.
Yes.
425-4787. Thanks on that one.
And they might very well get my answering machine and all, but I'll get back. And
We might be able to organize a little more formally tomorrow if we get a hold of the Quakers. And
today is a Sunday Quaker affair. And there's also another possibility is every Sunday at 11, and that's coming up in 15 minutes at the Loudoun Nelson Center, there's a breakfast done by, I guess it's Dennis Adams, a pastor for a Watsonville church that used to serve on Pacific Avenue, but now serves indoors. Great breakfast, I understand. You know, bacon and eggs and all kinds of yummy stuff.
Where is that?
That's down at Loudoun Nelson Center. Loudoun. You might want to just sort of drive down there and coordinate.
He gives whatever he has away, I think, doesn't he? Whatever supplies he has.
He may well do that, but he also may be a person to kind of advise, and it's sort of it's a concentration point for people in the community at this particular time of day. So.
Yeah, at 11, eh?
Yeah.
In 15 minutes.
I'll go down there.
Sounds good.
Chris, can you come along?
Yeah.
And don't eat too much bacon down there. It's a little too tasty, I understand.
Hey, I'm a veggie, you know that.
No, okay, well, I don't know about their vegetarian side, but when they were doing meals on the sidewalk, they had both vegetarian stew and meat stew. That's the only group I knew that were trying to feed everybody in town that way. Naturally, they were well disliked by the merchant community, who just thought they had to be put indoors away from making the poverty visible. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's great that you're looking into this, and I'm gonna open up the phone lines for a discussion on this. I should also say that we may have somebody calling from San Francisco from the Coalition on Homelessness on, kind of who's listened to David Lazarus's recent discussion of shelter expansion, or I should say, affordable housing / shelter tax up in San Francisco. It would be nice to have a tax in Santa Cruz, do something like that. Anyway, Carl, Chris, thank you. Anything you want to add?
Robert, I want you to give me the Huff number, because I think I've misplaced it.
Sure, the Huff number is pretty easy to remember. Huff, for those who don't know and are listening in, is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, an organization that concerns itself with civil rights for poor people and empowerment. And it's 423-HUFF, 423-4833.
Okay.
Okay.
If I get anything more formal organized, like through the Quakers, Robert, I'll put it on your Huff.
Much thanks. There's also a Huff website for those who want to go there, www.huffsantacruz, one word, Huff, H-U-F-F, Santa Cruz, one word, all one word, .org, and lots of information about ongoing civil rights struggles and the whole homeless scene there.
Okay.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Robert.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Robert.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye. And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Phone lines are 427-3772. I got a silent guest who's been kind of looking over the whole situation here, listening to the whole interview with David Lazarus. He was the fellow you may have heard on the phone earlier, Jeffrey Helms. Helms, is that right? Jeffrey, is that right?
Yes.
It is Helms. And I want you to kind of take your time in terms of what you've been kind of listening to all this, and you kind of grabbed me by the arm when I was getting into my car and said, hey. You'd heard a broadcast, and you kind of wanted to give a historical review of how things were back in the 80s around the Trollbuster time. Wasn't that? That's kind of why
yes.
we got together there.
Yes, I grew up camping around the M Align place or area,
uh-huh.
And there was a group there called the Friends of M Align.
Right.
And I had been camping there maybe 2 weeks at the most, maybe a month. And these people had this huge Great Dane bull mastiff mix, and they were sicking their dog on the people there that were homeless. Not just me, but other people.
This is back by 84, 85, something like that?
This went on between 85 and 93.
Uh-huh.
And
that long.
These people thought it was okay to sick this huge monster dog on homeless people. And I don't know what this was about. I don't know if other people made these people mad or what, but in general, they were sicking this dog on homeless people.
And what was the reaction of the authorities? This, I guess, is in the county jurisdiction. Right?
People told me to call the police, and I did, in fact, call the police. I was pretty young at the time, and I thought maybe the police would do something about it, which they didn't. What happened was the police told me to go to small claims court.
Oh, sort of for your injuries, get mauled and then go to small claims
court? Well, the dog would come up and tear my clothes and wouldn't break the skin. It was trained well enough where it wouldn't break the skin, but it would tear up my clothes, and it would chase me through the woods or across the parking lot or whatever, and I would run screaming. Eventually, I got braver and braver and braver. I got more used to this dog attacking me, and I was inflicted with a lung ailment called Valley Fever, which is quite common, but I was able to breathe, and I was able to camp out there and make it up to forage for food. And I would come out at night to forage for food and then go back and wheeze back at my camp. So I wasn't feeling well. And there were other people there that weren't quite feeling well. These are victims of the American Medical Association. People with mental problems.
Vets, perhaps? Any vets?
Yeah, there were lots of vets there. And mm-hmm. these people were torturing these people with this huge dog.
And did you ever find out the name of this dog? Did it have a name?
No. I'm not sure the name of the dog, but apparently they had trained this dog to do just what I said, was tear people's clothes. And
did you keep coming back to the camp anyway? I mean,
I didn't have a choice.
Look, I mean, you could have moved the camp somewhere else.
Well, no, I was so sick that I was unable to breathe, and I was so sick that I was able to make it down there, and that was it.
Uh-huh.
I went to the hospital, and the Valley Fever skin test, which they gave me, was bogus, and they couldn't figure out what I had, so I wasn't sure what was.
Did you stay at this one location for 8 years, or was there, you know?
Off and on, yes. I camped in the area off and on for. I still am, and I just broke up with my girl, and I'm back there now for the past week.
And what? And is the dog's son there now, or what's happening?
I don't know. I haven't seen this dog since 93, so I'm not sure.
Wow. And how are the police treating people who are camping in the area? I'd heard there was some kind of crackdown at Emmeline a month or two ago.
I'm not sure what's going on with that. I haven't had any problems. The other people are the blatant people that are right on the trail are probably getting harassed by the police, yes.
Have things changed, would you say, in the last 10, 20 years around homeless and how the police are treating them, and then the homeless, now the communities are treating them, or are things the same, or how have they changed, if they've changed?
I don't think the police really want to deal with this issue. They don't want to go down there and do this. I think the community people are naive and not understanding about the homeless people and what's really going on behind the scenes. I have something to say to the community action groups that do this, like the Friends of Harvey West Park, the Friends of Emmeline.
Who are these people, the Friends of Harvey West Park?
These are people that the homeowners in the area that don't like squatters. And a lot of times the property doesn't belong to these homeowners, but they don't want it in their backyard because of the smell, the noise, whatever. It lowers the real estate value. I don't know. But whether you're a woman fleeing from abuse, where you're a kid starting on your own, where you have personal financial difficulty, mental illness, you're a victim of the AMA, whether you're a victim of bathtub speed, where you have a physical problem, or you're going to need a place to stay. And these people have no choice but to be homeless. And there's a lot of traps out there for these homeless people. There's drugs and alcohol, there's malnutrition, there's tobacco, racism, the American Medical Association. These people get exposed to all this. And not to mention a huge rent wage differential. You know, it's really hard. It's expensive to get a place to live around here. And these community action groups aren't very understanding to the real issues that cause people to be homeless.
Not in my backyard. Vigilantes is what I like to call them. I kind of ran into some of their reps at the police station on of incidents that happen. If you have a problem in your community, you can put it onto this particular web, and you know, we can try to coordinate a response. But I call them NIMBY vigilantes, and I know that it's not all cut and dry. It's not all black and white, in the sense that people who live in neighborhoods, who live in houses, who own houses, some of them have legitimate concerns. I mean, that you're trying to raise a family, or you're trying to survive in a horribly inflated rental economy, or sure. and a depressed economy for jobs, and if even if you're a business owner, a depressed economy for making any kind of business work, that doesn't give you license to suddenly decide you're going to criminalize people who are much poorer than you are for your benefit, or because you're anxious about it. I mean, to me, that's never been justified. But look how we got an incoming call. Maybe this is the mayor calling in to give her view. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, is this Robert?
It is.
Hey, Robert, this is Bradley from Santa Cruz IMC. I'm live on the air.
Yes, and you...
That's just where I wanted to be.
Okay, well, Bradley, you're from Miami, right?
I am in Atlanta. Oh, I'm in Columbus, Georgia right now.
Oh, okay, you got away from those Miami people?
Yeah.
Oh, last I heard, you were shot at or shot and in the middle of the FTAA protests?
Yeah, I was shot with it's not a fucking rubber bullet, and I'm tired of people calling them rubber bullets. They're not just rubber bullets. I mean, this is very hard plastic.
Yeah, I know that I've seen those bullets on the streets in Los Angeles, maybe different ones, in 2000 when my producer, Becky Johnson, was... I don't think she was... She was hit with a club, actually, and she won a settlement.
Yeah.
But there were bullets all over.
The wound to my leg is nothing. There's people in the Miami jail right now that are being tortured.
Tell me more.
What we need people to do is to take time to go online to the... Oh, I need to get the phone number for you, too. But right now, go to the FTAAIMC.org website.
Let me go on to Indie Media while we're talking, and I will try to assist you with that, because that's where we'll... Indie Media should be covering it. Go to www.santacruz.indymedia.org.
No, go to ftaaimc.org.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I'll go back and do that then.
Okay.
Because I know that your report is appearing also there. There's a... I guess.
But that was just one little report.
Okay, so give again the... Here's FTA protest report. That's not going to be good to go to that one then?
No.
Okay, so give me the proper website.
Go to ftaaimc.org.
ftaaimc.org.
And do the best they can to scrape their funds together and donate. You can donate online to the bail. Money is needed very urgently for bail. Mm-hmm. There's still... the numbers are not exactly clear, but there may be up to 200 people in jail still.
Well, here's what the article reads. Our legal team estimates more than 250 arrests. People who become political prisoners being held in jail. More than 50 of them were arrested while holding a peaceful vigil outside the jail in solidarity with those inside. Is that right?
Yeah. If you could read that whole article on the air, that would be fantastic.
Sure. Is there anything that isn't in this article, which was posted today, it looks like, that we should know about? Anything? Any updates?
Well, just that there's been some serious physical torture going on inside the jails in Miami.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I can do that. I can read this article.
And so just to let folks know that it's very important.
Sure.
That bail money be raised. It's not like outrageous bail amounts. Apparently, it's between like $100 and $5,000.
Anybody from Santa Cruz jail to?
I do not know that information, but there is, on that website, on that page that you're reading, there is a link, I think, with people that are in jail.
Uh-huh.
I haven't seen it myself.
Okay, I'll take a look. I know the Democracy Now! Producer was jailed. Is that producer still being held?
I think that, no, Anna Nogueira was released.
Okay. On bail or OR'd?
I'm not sure. I think bail, but I'm not sure.
Okay. How you doing, Bradley?
I'm doing good. I'm fine. I'm at the School of the Americas.
Oh, you've decided to become a torturer, perhaps? No, you're outside the School of the Americas, right?
Right, yeah, we're trying to shut it down.
Uh-huh. Any report on that?
Well, I guess some nonviolent civil disobedience has taken place, just the crossing of the line onto the base, and some people have been arrested. For the latest information on that, go to atlanta.indymedia.org.
Atlanta.indymedia.org for those who are interested. We're talking with Bradley in Florida. Is that right?
No, I'm at Fort Benning, Georgia.
Fort Benning, Georgia. Sorry. You get around there, Bradley.
Yeah, I was in Miami.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe Scott Kennedy, with his devotion to nonviolence, our new mayor, he'll be mayor in 3 days, could join you and show solidarity.
Yeah, that would be great for Scott and anyone else out there to show solidarity with the people in the Miami jail that urgently need our help. I mean, what's going on here at the School of the Americas is very important, and it's very important, like Mother Jones says, that we pray for the dead and fight like hell for the living, and right now there's people living but being tortured inside the Miami jail.
Let me ask you a subsidiary question, Bradley, because this show normally concerns itself a lot with civil rights for poor people. What do you see? How did the homeless people react to these huge demonstrations in Miami and the police the response? Did you get any sense of that, or were you sort of wrapped up in other things while this was going?
Well, I talked to a homeless person. He was very supportive of what we were doing. I mean, most people in Miami had no idea what was going on, so they wouldn't necessarily be in support or not in support. They just didn't know, and understandably, when you're sleeping under a bridge every night, you're not up on all the latest issues on free trade agreements.
In the studio with me is Jeffrey. He's got a question for you.
Yeah.
Yes, I would like to know if you could elaborate on the torture processes that are going on down there.
There is some stuff posted online about the torture.
Could you please tell us this right now, or?
Yeah, I want to.
I'm actually looking
well,
at the...
Well, let me tell you this story. I talked to one man while I'm jogging up this information. I talked to one man from Miami who is a houseless person, and he was telling me a story about the police in Miami and how they had asked him, are you panhandling, sir? This is not while I was there. This is just one of his stories of Miami police, just to get that clear. A Miami police officer asked this man in a wheelchair, are you panhandling? And he said, no, I'm not panhandling. And the police officer came up behind him, grabbed the back of his wheelchair, physically dumped this man out of his chair and into the street, and let his chair roll away from him. And then went back in his car, the police officer went back in his car and watched the man struggle to get back into the chair and just like laughed about it and didn't drive and then drove away after the man in the chair finally got back in the chair and went away.
It's kind of ironic, Bradley, because Miami is the place where the Pottinger guidelines were formed and are supposedly enforced, and these are the rules put down by federal courts, not, for example, that they're not operational in Santa Cruz, but they are in Miami, that says police cannot approach homeless people on what's called survival life-sustaining behavior, such as camping, sleeping, public nudity, all these things that you get tickets for in Santa Cruz, you get hassled for in Santa Cruz and in many other cities. The ACLU won $1.5 million in Miami in 1998, stopping this from happening, supposedly. So panhandling, I'm not sure where that falls into it, though to me panhandling has always been First Amendment activity, free speech, unless it goes into harassment and abuse. Then it's perhaps another matter. Anyway, we're talking
about... Let me get back to Jeffrey's question.
Sure.
There's excessive brutality in the jails, sexual assault, and torture going on inside. People of color... queer and transgender prisoners are particularly being targeted, and there is a confirmed report of one Latino man arrested along with 62 others outside the Miami-Dade County Jail Friday, who is currently hospitalized in the intensive care unit for an injury he received after being beaten in the head with a nightstick by an arresting officer.
This was outside the jail. He got beaten and then he was hospitalized, or is he beaten inside the jail?
It's,
or don't you know? I mean, you might not
received,
know.
It doesn't say where. He was beaten by the arresting officer. I'm not sure if that was inside or outside the jail, but definitely within the jail is excessive brutality, sexual assault, and torture, and with particular targeting of people of color and people that are queer and transgender.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to read this article, Bradley, aloud so that people can catch it, and they can also go directly to the website, www.ftaaimc.org.
Right, and that will give them a link for online donations. Is www.unitedforpeace.org/FTAA donate. So www.unitedforpeace.org/FTAA donate, and then for people that don't have that access, they can send a check or money order to United for Peace and Justice. /FTAA fund. I hope you guys are grabbing your pens and pencils out there. Come on, Santa Cruz, and if you're rebroadcasting this in Olympia and Point Arena in Mendocino, this is urgent. United for Peace and Justice /FTAA fund, P.O. Box 607, Times Square Station, New York, New York, 10108, and please specify legal fund in the memo field. And and then the number for legal, in case you're wondering about your friends in Santa Cruz or elsewhere for that matter, the legal hotline is 305-400-6445. So you can call legal and inquire about your friends. And another good website to check for latest information is stopftaa.org, and then it has a link to legal, so you could go right there and check out the latest.
Okay, that's a lot of info. Go ahead.
If you could just like read that whole article, that'd be great. Regarding the man in Miami who got dumped by the police officer, I do have an audio interview with him, and if all goes well, I'll get that posted and available to the world as soon as possible, you know, Tuesday or Wednesday.
That'll be on the Santa Cruz Indie Media?
I'm not sure exactly where I'll be posting everything. I'll probably be posting the stuff from Florida to the FTAA site, and stuff like pictures I've taken here and audio interviews here in Atlanta will be posted to the Atlanta site. And then I'll do a post to Santa Cruz Indie Media with links to all
Sounds
my
good.
Posts on all the different sites.
Okay. Fair enough. We're listening long distance direct to Fort Benning, Georgia, where Bradley of the Santa Cruz Indie Media is roaming from FTAA, stopping them, to stopping the School of the Americas, also known as the, what's got some weird new name, what's it called?
Yeah, it's the Western Hemisphere Institute of Security Cooperation.
Oh ho, of happy campers,
so,
right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. New name, same shame.
Hey, nicely said. Anything more?
Fuck the FCC.
And free the people in Miami.
Okay.
Pray for the dead and fight like hell for the living.
You're here.
Right on.
Hey.
Anything else you want to tell the listeners of Free Radio out there?
All right.
Thanks, Bradley.
Thanks a lot.
All righty.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Take you out there. Bye.
And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. We are also broadcasting at 101.1 FM, and we are streaming on the Internet, I hope, at www.freakradio.org. You want to email us, you can email the radio station, actually email me on the show. You should email rnorse2@hotmail.com. rnorse2@hotmail.com. Hoping we can, I'm taking a quick look now to see if there's any incoming email. Nothing yet. Come on, folks. 427-3772 is the phone number if you want to reach us. And I promised I would read this article, and I'm going to do so. This is, of course, an important issue for everyone. It's not something I normally cover in detail, but when events are happening as they are in Miami and Fort Benning, I think it's important to be able to interrupt what's going on here to keep people advised. Urgent call to action. FTAA protesters brutalized Miami. This is by the Direct Action Contingency, and it was written, I guess, at 2:47 this morning. Our legal team estimates more than 250 arrests. People have become political prisoners and are being held in jail. More than 50 of them were arrested while holding a peaceful vigil outside the jail in solidarity with those inside. They were surrounded by riot police in order to disperse. As they did, police opened fire and blocked the streets, preventing many from leaving. We are now receiving reports from people being released or calling from jail that there is an excessive brutality, sexual assault, and torture going on inside. People of color, queer and transgender prisoners are particularly being targeted. There is a confirmed report of one Latino man arrested along with 62 others outside the Miami-Dade County Jail Friday, who is currently hospitalized in the intensive care unit for an injury he received after being beaten in the head with a nightstick by an arresting officer. I heard Bradley say this earlier. This week, thousands of protesters came to Miami to oppose the FTAA, the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, which is an international trade agreement that aims to extend corporate control throughout the Western Hemisphere. Prior to the mass action, there was a calculated campaign on the part of the police to intimidate and harass protesters. One officer characterized this campaign by saying, "You can beat the rap, but not the ride." As we feared, our protests were met by a massive show of state repression backed by $8.5 million in U.S. government funding. Miami Police Commissioner John Timoney oversaw a massive paramilitary assault on our constitutional and human rights. Protesters were attacked by police wielding batons, tear gas, pepper spray, rubber, wooden and plastic bullets, and other chemical agents. Over 100 protesters were treated for injuries. 12 were hospitalized. Police dispersed large groups of peaceful protesters with tear gas, pepper spray, and open fire. Small groups leaving the protests were harassed, arrested, and beaten. This campaign of fear and intimidation culminated in the closure and militarization of downtown Miami. There were confirmed reports of military tanks patrolling the streets after dark on Thursday night. Our legal team estimates more than 250 arrests. People have become political prisoners or being held in jail, and more than 50 of them were arrested while holding a peaceful vigil outside the jail in solidarity with those inside. They were surrounded by riot police in order to disperse. As they did, police opened fire and blocked the streets, preventing many from leaving. People have been denied access to attorneys, visitation rights, vegetarian or vegan food, and access to essential medication and medical attention. We call on people from around the globe to take action immediately to support our sisters and brothers who are being unfairly arrested and brutalized. We're calling for three immediate actions. One, call, fax, email elected officials of the demands listed below, contact information below. Two, money is urgently needed to get people out of jail. They're making everyone post between $100,000 and $5,000 in bail. We're working with bail bondsmen, but this is not enough. Send money to cover legal and jail support expenses, including bail, getting people rides back home, and other legal costs. Please send money to... And then there's a blank space, unfortunately. It looks like further on down, online donations are possible at http://www.unitedforpeace.org/FTAA donate. One word, FTAA donate, one word. You can get this by going online. You can get all this information at the www.ftaaimc.org website. And by the way, if you miss any of this, and I know I'm going through it pretty fast, you can always give a call to 423-HUFF. That's the off-air number that I use to pick up messages. And it's also the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom website. I'll be happy to kind of repeat this stuff or get you access to it again. if I can. You can also mail a check or money order to the United for Peace and Justice FTAA Fund, P.O. Box 607, Times Square Station, New York, New York 10108. Please specify legal fund in the memo field. And there's a global day of action on Monday. That's tomorrow at any time and any appropriate action. This could be U.S. embassies, Departments of Justice, or FBI offices. And I assume we're talking nonviolent actions. These are our demands. A, drop all charges. B, release all political prisoners. C, meet basic human needs. No more brutality. Provide appropriate food, access to medicine and medical attention, warm clothing. D, provide access to attorneys and visitation rights. E, provide equitable treatment to all prisoners. F, do not share information collected with the INS. G, fire Chief Timoney. I assume that's the police chief. And there's a whole series of other phone numbers, such as the mayor of Miami and the mayor of Miami-Dade County and chief of police, state attorney, et cetera, et cetera. Again, you get all this information, www.ftaiimc.org. Check it out. So, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM. I'm going to take a breather here. We're going to have another kind of more relaxed kind of song, or it's actually kind of a humorous song, one of my favorite songs called Penis Envy. Stay with us. Actually, we're going to finish Fat Boys, and then we're going to get Penis Envy. How's that for a laugh?
Truly discerning the loves of us all, we can turn up the music and turn on the covers with the Fat Boys, Fat Boys. Fat Boys, Fat Boys, Fat Boys. Fat Boys so massive and Fat Boys so sweet. Fat Boys to fondle and bite. Fat Boys to feed me whenever we meet. Fat Boys to turn out the light. Fat Boys so ample to sample and hold. Fat Boys to brighten my day. Fat Boys so grand to manhandle and mold. Fat Boys to steal me away. All of that extra cheek, all of that extra cargo to carry gives me another reason to marry them.
Truly determined, we go through the pace. We're pumping and chest, so we're stuffing our faces for the Fat Boys, Fat Boys.
Everyone takes a peek. Truly determined, we go through the pace. We're pumping our chest, so we're stuffing our faces for the Fat Boys, Fat Boys. Fat Boys, Fat Boys, Fat Boys. Fat Boys.
Penis, I'd wear it outside in cafes and car lots with pomp and with pride. If I had a penis, I'd pamper it proper. I'd stay in the tub and use me as the stopper. If I had a penis, I'd take it to parties, stretch it and stroke it and shove it at smarties. I'd take it to pet shows and teach it to stay. I'd stuff it in turkeys on Thanksgiving Day. I'd rival my buddies in sports cars and stick shifts. I'd shower my spire with girlies and gifts. I'd peek around corners, I'd aim at my toilet. I'd poke it at foreigners and soap it and oil it. If I had a penis, I'd run to my mother, comb out the hair and compare it to brother. I'd lance her, I'd knight her, my hands would indulge. Hands would sink tighter and bustle and bulge. A penis to plunder, a penis to push, 'cause one in the hand is worth one in the bush. A penis to love me, a penis to share. To pick up and play with when nobody's there. I'd sit like a guy, I'd straddle the chair. I'd play with my fly, albeit with care. I'd dip it in chocolate, I'd stick it in sockets. I'd stroll to the movies with hands deep in pockets. I'd stick it in vacuums on vacant verandas. Gas-guzzling bottles and poodles and pandas. And puddles and drain pipes and doggies and ditches. Pools and bottles and bitches. Zucchinis and zebras, tomatoes, tomatoes. And pineapple pumpkins and gulches and grottos. And melons and marshmallows.
Gloves and gorillas. Slurpees and slippers, Chinooks and chinchillas. A penis to plunder, a penis to push, 'cause one in the hand is worth one in the bush. A penis to love me, a penis to share. To pick up and play with when nobody's there. If I had a penis, I'd climb every mountain.
I'd force it on females, I'd pee like a fountain.
If I had a penis, I'd still be a girl. But I'd make much more money and conquer the world.
And we're back in the studio with Jeffrey Helms and me, Robert Norris. Give us a call at 427-3772. Jeffrey, what'd you think of the Lazarus stuff? The Chronicle fellow. You had some comments on that.
Yes. He wanted to appropriate money for housing the hardcore chronically homeless people in San Francisco, which a lot of them do have mental problems and hardcore drug habits and alcohol habits. This is not feasible in my idea. I think the only feasible alternative to housing would be a large-scale camping area or a small-scale camping area, which would be financially appropriate and easily done. It doesn't make sense to me to put somebody with really bad mental problems into a small space where they're going to probably not stay there and probably ruin their environment and cause problems, which would be a cluster, you know, bleep, bleep, bleep for everyone.
Clusterfuck, eh? Well, you know, I guess I disagree with your perception of people labeled mentally ill. I mean, I think people who may act real weird on the streets can, you know, do just fine in their housing. Although, I mean, obviously people have housing problems who are mentally ill, some who aren't mentally ill. I mean, depends on, you know, all kinds of circumstances. I think obviously first of all, I think it should be voluntary. And I think if it's voluntary, that's much different. People are more likely to respect their environment if it's something that they aren't forced or caged or herded into. But you had the impression, I think you said, that David is really, because of his opposition to giving to panhandlers, you mm-hmm. suggested that perhaps he really wants to remove people from the streets, a la Gavin Newsom stuff, you know, tough love or whatever you want to call that stuff. I call it a neighborhood NIMBY vigilantism,
a lot of these people don't have any choice but to panhandle. That's how they make their living, and they're forced to ask people for money. I don't think David understands this. And I think if he were in a position, if he were hungry or without shelter, I think he would probably do the same.
Here's an article by David Lazarus on panhandling. San Francisco hotel operators are on the right track with a new ad campaign. He claimed he opposed it, but here is this article supporting it. Maybe he changed his mind in a later article. Beginning today, this is an article on the April 25th from the Chronicle. I got it off the website. That urges people not to dole out spare change to the city's legion of panhandlers. But our sidewalks are overrun with beggars, not because these people are all, as the ad suggests, junkies and hookers, although it might seem that way to merchants who say filthy downtown streets are driving away business. Rather, street people of all stripes flock to San Francisco with outstretched hands for one reason and one reason only. It's profitable. I think he's off base here. I spent time with panhandlers up and down Market Street and was surprised to learn that most earn about $30 a day for their efforts. Multiply that by, say, 100 beggars citywide, a vastly conservative estimate, and it's clear that thousands of dollars are being provided in handouts every day. Now, $30 a day for panhandling, let's say 8 hours a day, that's about $4, a little less than $4 an hour, so it's about what? Two-thirds, maybe half the minimum wage. And the idea that this is sort of, you know, oh, you just sit in your chair and it comes to you is ridiculous. Panhandling is work, as far as I know. If you want to panhandle, it takes energy to do so. Go ahead.
I was wondering if David himself is appropriating funds for the homeless. Does he make his living from the homeless? Is he a panhandler, but in a different sort?
Well, he's, of course, a business columnist who mainly doesn't write about homeless stuff. I mean, he's written a couple of columns recently, and this is another one he wrote way back when. I guess it's true that people who you know, who make a salary at the Chronicle and who do write about this to some extent, a certain percentage obviously comes from the subject matter they write about. I guess he could be writing about something else. Anyway, he says, he goes into this, multiply that $30 a day by, say, 100 beggars citywide, a vastly conservative estimate, and it's clear that thousands of dollars are being provided in handouts every day. The problem isn't the panhandlers, it's us. Paul Cook, 40, passes a day sitting on an old plastic milk crate near the old Navy store on 4th Street. His cat, Mutt, rests in a basket on his feet, the lure for passersby to leave coins in a paper cup. People are nice and generous, Cook says contentedly. It's a great city. It's hard to see this changing as a result of ads that feature smiling tourists in the words, "Today we rode a cable car, visited Alcatraz, and supported a drug habit," which were the billboard signs to discourage panhandling. Another ad, "Today I did Tai Chi, donated some change, and helped spread STDs. The campaign, costing $65,000, will focus primarily on ads atop taxis and on the sides of buses." "We're just saying that giving panhandlers a few cents does more harm than good," said Bob Begley, executive director of the San Francisco Hotel Council. "You're just increasing the problem." And the article goes on. He sounds ambivalent about these signs. He begins, however, by saying San Francisco hotel operators are on the right track with a new ad campaign beginning today. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he doesn't even know his own position, or maybe it's changed, or maybe it's mixed. You know, I mean, just the basic reality is people have the right to give money or not to give money. And, you know, a lot of us get approached sufficiently frequently that we're reluctant to give out money because we're afraid of being conned. We feel pushed around. We don't have any money to give out. There are all kinds of reasons. And you know, the fact is people still obviously feel the need to ask for it. And I guess the idea that there are some people who do so professionally for other reasons. Now, you know, I mean, maybe they don't, their needs, I guess they don't really need it. They're just faking. They're making money off of you, and they shouldn't be allowed to do so. They're a big nuisance. All these things kind of come together in a cluster of arguments, which, you know, some of them are attractive arguments, but that's what the Constitution is for me. And the Constitution says you don't deny people's right to make a request.
Yes.
Even if it's for money.
Where do we draw the line? What if a woman is fleeing from abuse, is out there and she's homeless and hungry, and she wants to ask such and such for a handout for
not in Santa Cruz after dark? That would be illegal. Any request for money, right, or anything of value after dark in Santa Cruz is punishable by $162 fine and second offense for
This is unfortunate for the woman fleeing from abuse, and that thus makes her
Maybe she could flee to Modesto, where it's not illegal, or maybe there's a different kind of law governing that. In other words, I think you're obviously right, but I think the real question is the claim here, and this is the bullshit that's put out by Gavin Newsom, and I don't think it's really put out explicitly by David Lazarus, but it is perhaps the background is that, you know, that there's some alternatives people have, that, you know, they don't really need to do this, that there are other services they could get, that they could go to women's shelter, you know, that there really is a place to go for emergency shelter tonight if you're homeless and poor in Santa Cruz, which there isn't if more than 160 people, or I think it's actually more than 120 people, show up. And so it's based on a mythology, which, of course, reassures people that, A, everything's okay, keep working harder for your rent. And yet this mythology is kind of double-edged because it's obviously false. People know that it's really false at some level. And therefore, they do work ever harder because they're afraid of being swallowed up into this great jaw, which says not only are you going to be homeless, but we're going to be making it as hard as possible for you on the streets because we don't even want to see you there, because it reminds us of what the hell is going on that we don't want to see.
Well, apparently they just passed a new law in San Francisco. Am I correct?
They have a new anti-panhandling law, which, by the way, is not as bad as Santa Cruz's anti-panhandling law. Go ahead.
And I don't think San Francisco can actually stop panhandling. I think they're just feeding the fire and making the problem worse and further hindering the homeless man or the unfortunate person.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, we've talked about this so much on this station, Jeffrey. Just, it's been a long, you know, it's, we've done it, and it's you know, it's true, I think, what you say. I'm kind of looking over some tapes now to see where I'm going to go next. By the way, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, 101.1 FM, and www.freakradio.org if you've got a computer, and you can call it 427-3772. I'm going to kind of dig up a couple things while I play you the beginnings of a discussion. This is actually part one of a two-part interview. I've already played part two. It's kind of backwards, but then again, I have a rather clumsy way of doing things on this particular show, but I think actually if all the information gets out, I'm happy. This is an interview with an activist and a contender for the Peace and Freedom Party congressional representative nomination, Joe Williams. Joe's a musician. He is one of the members of SAFE, Society for Artistic Freedom of Expression, which has been supporting those fighting tickets for playing a guitar with an open case within the forbidden 10-foot zone, for not moving along every hour. The whole bunch of merchant paranoia laws that were passed thanks to Candy Jackson and the Heinrichs of the Pacific Trading Company, and of course our Santa Cruz City Council, the Rotkin-Riley City Council, last summer, and now the new council, which made them even worse this last winter, 2003, in January. Joe talks about his struggles to make sure that there was some changes made. Kennedy was supposed to come back with a whole series of a reexamination of the downtown ordinances after 6 months, the laws that expand the you can't sit, you can't play, perform, you can't table, you can't peacefully ask for a dime within certain forbidden zones, and it's actually much worse for a panhandling generally, particularly with respect to how it affects street performers. I mean, I've talked before about how street performers, the idea of street performers having their own little special cliquey guild group and not concerning themselves with the rights of other people is something that really I don't like. But I'm also glad, I'm hopeful, I've joined this group, this cliquey little guild that I say I don't like, because I don't want to see it be a cliquey little guild. I want to see it be a group of, an inclusive group that whose activity ultimately supports that of everybody and the right to stand up for everyone's rights, First Amendment rights on the street, the right to use public spaces, for God's sake, on the sidewalk, even if you don't have a permit from every business in town, even if they all don't like you. Tough shit. You should have a right to do these, to associate with your friends, to be in public spaces, to sit down, provided you're not blocking the road, to ask for money if you need to ask for money, provided you're not doing so in a threatening or abusive or obstructive way. And we're going to listen to an interview from this summer by Joe Williams about this issue, which I had with him, and I found it rather interesting, and I played part of it before. Here's the other part of it that I didn't play. Okay, well, it's September 12th. September 11th has come and gone. We still have the Patriot Act, the move-along law, the downtown ordinances, the sleeping ban. Goodness knows, lots of shit. And what time you got there, Joe Williams?
10:30.
Got 10:30. We're out here on Portola, taking in the shade on a hot day. And, Joe, you're kind of looking over the summer. We last talked on Free Radio about, well, you debated Councilmembers Kennedy and Rotkin, as soon to be Mayor Kennedy, I fear, and Councilmember Rotkin around the issue of downtown ordinances and street performers, particularly, since you yourself are a performer, although not a frequent street performer, but certainly an occasional street performer.
I've paid my dues.
Yes. You originally were looking for a six-month, well, you opposed the downtown ordinances when they initially came out last year in June and July.
Yes.
And you then opposed the move-along law, which was, as well as the 10-foot restrictions that came out in January.
Yeah.
And you took seriously the promises made by the council, including Councilmember Kennedy, that there would be a way to deal with the so-called issue of the dolphins, the street performers caught in the tuna net. The net was supposed to get rid of the unsavory people downtown, or at least unsavory behavior downtown. Actually, I think it's clearly these were anti-homeless laws that they had to use to generically deal with everyone, or they would be found unconstitutional. Although, ironically, they didn't do that, and they haven't been challenged in court. Hopefully, they will be. Anyway, at that time in January, you looked to Councilmember Kennedy's promise that there would be, the whole council's promise, there would be a review in June or July of this last summer. the issue of a display device where musicians put cups in front of them or hats or guitar cases would be
exempted.
Yeah. Tell us some of the other things you had hoped would be addressed or you felt were they explicitly promised to address.
Well, I guess there's a few things that are still, you know, floating around out there that have not been dealt with in a fashion that I feel and many other people feel they should have been dealt with. We're still looking for a 6-month review of the downtown ordinances. The full council promised that, so we don't need to single out Kennedy. That hasn't happened. I don't know if it ever will happen. I don't know, you know, what kind of...
Emily Riley was promising that will happen after the vacation. Of course, she was saying similar things about the U.S. out of Iraq resolution, which completely disappeared, too. So Riley is not too fastidious about these things.
Well, I like to hold the council responsible, so, I mean, I'd say the entire council.
Riley sets the agenda of the council.
Well, okay. So you've got a 6-month review that didn't happen that still needs to happen. When I was on free radio, you know, talking things over with Rockin' Kennedy, it just became clear, it's like, what the limits of, like, what they were prepared to do and what they were prepared not to do. So I think it's a matter of, you know, community pressure on them to, like, hold them, you know, accountable to, like, at least the stuff they said they were going to
do.
Well,
that's what we're looking at, the stuff they said they were going to do, which included, the review included this idea of they were going to promise that a display device could be allowed.
Right. Well, I'll just take them one by one. First of all the ordinances need to be examined to whether they've been effective or whatever, and there's debate on whether it's, like, fostered a you know, a more genteel atmosphere downtown or not.
30% more tickets.
Of course, my interpretation of that is we have a little mini police state going on downtown, but it's open to debate. Depending on, you know, whose shoes you're standing in at the time. So we've got the 6-month review. We've also got Tom Noddy's been, you know, talking about this 10-foot distance restriction and how he feels he can get that either modified or changed. That's part of the whole idea you mentioned, you know, the Dolphins caught in a tuna net. The Dolphins at the time being used to refer to political tablers and street performers downtown, how the council bent over backwards to say, oh, this has nothing to do with political tablers, it has nothing to do with street performers, you know, they don't cause really the problems, we'll fix the ordinances to, you know, reflect this stuff. So,
in fact, Rodkin was saying this summer that he's sure that the police don't stand there with a stopwatch when, didn't you in fact see officers timing people in front of the Pacific Trading Company at their table?
Oh, sure. No, I took a shift there one afternoon just to check it out for myself, and I got timed out after an hour by, I guess it was CSO, is it Pollock? I got timed out after an hour. So, yeah, it's happening down there. There's no question cops are there with issuing time stamps or whatever.
Although there was an ending of the strict enforcement after the arrests of Steve Argy and Matthew Hartog for violating the so-called 60 minutes and get out of here rule, and they began ignoring the move-along law, except with respect to homeless people who they wanted to move along, who actually weren't really vulnerable to the law, except if they had something in front of them that could be construed as a display device. So, and there has been a lessening of enforcement.
Well, I mean, be that as it may, that's fine. The laws are still on the books, and I think just this kind of stuff, this, if you want to call it selective enforcement, discretionary enforcement, whatever, what have you, it's all dependent upon the police making their own determinations downtown about what laws they're going to enforce and when and against whom. This makes it real problematic for street performers and political tablers to know, like, what to expect when they go down there. The bottom line effect of all this is to chill those types of activities, whether or not, not knowing whether or not the police, CSOs, and downtown hosts, hospitality guides, are going to, like, you know, be in your face about whatever your activity, depending on, like, what group you're representing or, you know, who you are personally.
Well, Tom Noddy tells us the fever has broken. That's what he said at the street performers celebration, I guess called Only in Santa Cruz, last weekend at Loudoun Nelson Center, and that there's no longer strict enforcement, that there's a more positive view. I think Tom has been meeting with Mayor Riley, hopefully to get some kind of... it's not even an exemption to the 10-foot rule. I think they're looking for an exemption to 10 feet only in front of areas where there aren't windows and doors, so people can stand in certain selected places with a guitar case on the sidewalk in front of a building, provided it doesn't block a window or a doorway.
have things gotten so significantly better that we need to relax about this issue and do what we can to accept the possible and forget about the impossible dream?
Well, see, this is a lot of it is why I guess I call it a mini police state, because it's really up to the police to decide, you know, when they're going to enforce. So there might be periods of lesser or greater enforcement down there, but that, to me, that's not an argument for anything. The laws are still going to be on the books. Police department personnel will change. City council members will change.
Dick Wilson will go on forever.
Perhaps. But the laws are still on the books, and they can be enforced to greater or lesser degree. The problem is that the laws are on the books, and the exemptions that were going to be created to keep the street performers and political tablers out of that euphemistic tuna net haven't been implemented. Council goes to great lengths to say, oh, we changed the language in the solicitation section of the municipal code to exempt anybody asking for tips. You know, you're not soliciting if you're a performer asking for tips in lieu of a performance.
Unconstitutional exemption, I might add.
Well, yeah, I mean, this kind of stuff, you know, this favoritism, plus the juggling thing, plus the, you know, the bubble blowing, all these little attempts to create, you know, favored exemption for certain personalities or certain types of activities down there isn't fair. From a legal standpoint or a moral standpoint, in my opinion, and council's promises to go back on the to go back and examine these things seems to have been deep sixed. I hope that's not the case. I still have hope that they're going to do their review of the ordinances whenever it becomes, you know, this budget crisis gets out, you know, from under it, or when they stop using it as an excuse to deep six discussion on anything else. But we've also got the issue of I mentioned the exemption for the street performers under solicitation, excuse me,
second handling,
yeah, of the municipal code. And what was promised, and this was even indicated in a March 7th memo, that Riley and Matthews were going to get together with Barisoni and work out language for the display device exemption. In other words, things smaller than a table. Now, this would help some. It's definitely not the end-all, be-all, but it would supposedly the language is that they were directed to create would exempt things like guitar cases, cups, and hats, things smaller than a table, since the issue for display device is sidewalk obstruction, and if you're not, you know, technically obstructing the sidewalk with a little cup or a little hat or a guitar case, then what's the problem? And they promised to do this and come back. Barisoni hasn't done anything on this. I don't know where Riley and Matthews stand on this. When I brought it up on the free radio with Rod Ken and Kennedy, they said, oh, well, that change was made in the solicitation. This was done before. The solicitation change was made previous to the promises made about the display device. This was yet another council promise that just kind of fell by the wayside. And
it's not my flyer, broken promises.
Well, however you want to look at it, it hasn't been dealt with yet. And I'm looking to see that they, you know...